From Charlton Heston parting the Red Sea to the terrifying dinosaurs running through Jurassic Park or the animated Rapunzel's long flowing hair, did you ever sit in a movie theater thinking, how did they do that? Well, this hour we're going to be pulling back the curtain to look at the science and art behind the magic of visual effects. How have visual effects changed through the years? What can computers do that filmmakers in the past only dreamt about? Plus, building a bridge that can survive the big one. The lead designer of a new eastern span of the Bay Bridge joins us. Why, he says, the bridge's design makes it one of the safest place to be during an earthquake. All that coming up after this break. Stay with us. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. We're here in California, broadcasting from the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. And while you might think Silicon Valley or biotech when you think of Northern California, this part of the state is also home to some of the biggest names in the movie business. Move over Hollywood. The movie stars here are the computers and the designers who create the animation and the visual effects that let actors do the impossible, electronically, of course. Engineers and mathematicians are developing technology and software that's transforming the movie business and the experiences of going to the movies. Wondering how they made Brad Pitt age backwards and Benjamin Button? How they created the squid-like Davy Jones character in Pirates of the Caribbean? How they made those Toy Story toys seem so lifelike? Well, we'll be talking about the science behind what you see on the silver screen and ask, will there come a time when technology gets so good we don't need those live-action folks, those human actors? Have you ever sat in a theater saying and thinking to yourself, how the heck did they do that? Well, we've got the experts here who are going to tell you. And if you're going to make it to the movies and you're a science geek, there's plenty of room to put those math and engineering skills to work in the movie business. So we're going to be talking about that today, and let me introduce my guest. Stephen Sullivan is Senior Technology Officer at Industrial Light and Magic. He's also a three-time Academy Award winner. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Sullivan.
Thanks.
Also with us is Tony DeRose. He's a Senior Scientist and Lead of the Research Group at Pixar Animation Studios. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. DeRose.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Greg Barron is co-founder and visual effects supervisor for Matt World Digital. He won an Academy Award in 2009 for his work on The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, and he joins us from NPR West. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira.
Let's get going to define some terms, Steve. Help us set the scene here. When we're talking about visual effects in movies, there are physical effects, and then there are computer-generated effects, right? Are these two of the broad categories?
Yeah, you know, it's imprecise, the terminology, but we often refer to special effects as being the things we do in camera. So you shoot that footage on set, versus visual effects is usually referring to the computer-generated stuff that we do after the fact to enhance or alter the image to help the director tell a story.
Give us an example of a movie or two where that we might see that kind of thing.
Oh, all over the place. Yeah.
Now it's all over the place.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have a movie coming out called Avengers that's going to have all these different computer-generated characters, but also computer-generated backgrounds and cityscapes that you would assume have just been shot that way on camera, but actually we added in to make the shooting easier later.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking in particular to the HBO series, Boardwalk Empire, where they really didn't have a boardwalk or the whole city, right?
Yeah.
They added all that stuff in.
A lot of our work is actually those so-called invisible effects, where the audience is not supposed to know anything's going on, but it makes the shooting a lot easier.
But there are cases like in the Pirates of the Caribbean, Davy Jones's head, right? I mean, it was like he's got these squid-like tentacles coming at him.
Yeah, actually, that's funny. People often asked us, where did the makeup stop, or what was real and what wasn't? The whole character was digital. There was no actor there on screen ever.
There was never any actor.
No, never was. But we took great pains and invented some new technology so that Bill Nighy could be on set with the other actors and drive the performance, and you can tell that's Bill's performance there, but it's all computer graphics on the screen.
And the Benjamin Button, that was the character's head, but nothing nothing else, right?
Right. Yeah, I think they had live actors there and replaced the head in most of the shots.
Greg, tell us about that.
Well, Ira, you know, you mentioned in the opening about sort of replacing the pesky actors, but it's really more of a collaboration. The actors are driving a performance, and it's up to the special effects person to capture that performance and allow it to be coming through with the computer-generated character.
Mm-hmm. Tony, let's talk about animation itself. In the old days, I remember from, you know, the old Disney days, the people that actually draw those cells one cell at a time. How has that changed now? What goes on now?
Well, in cell animation, often a senior animator would draw keyframes, you know, maybe every 15 or 20 frames of film apart. And then the ink and paint department and in-betweeners would come along to fill in all the motion in between those key poses that the senior animators would provide. Today, we still have senior animators creating those key poses, those points in time where acting and emotion is really delivered. And then we use various mathematical methods to do the in-betweening automatically.
How do they know what to do? How does the computer know what to do? I mean, a person would know, I would think, logically, mm-hmm. but so it must be very complicated algorithms or something.
Well, the algorithms themselves really aren't that complicated. We use pieces of polynomials that algebra students learn about in class. We happen to use third-degree polynomials. So the mathematics isn't that complicated, but the skill of the artist is, and the animators are really what cause that mathematics to right. you know, let the emotion come through.
In an animated film like Toy Story, the characters were stylized, but what about the world they live in, the way their clothes move or the way the light looks? Do you try to mirror reality in that way also?
Well, so much of an audience's expectations about motion are governed by, you know, physics in the real world. But we're not constrained by physics. We use physics kind of as a starting point, as a jumping off point. And then we try to make our worlds and our motion even better than reality.
Mm-hmm. So what are the hardest things for an animator to do? What skin color, tone, what are the hardest things to recreate?
Well, for the whole filmmaking process, capturing that emotion in a performance is very difficult, and that's what our animators bring to the table. Once mm-hmm. the emotion is there, then other artists are responsible for making sure that, you know, the plastic looks like it should and that the lighting is going to reflect the desires of the director. And then algorithms kick in to try to take the input from the artists and finally create the beautiful pixels you see in the theater. Mm.
Craig Barron, tell us about, has anybody actually made a totally digital character in a live-action movie?
Well, sure. You know, that is actually one of the exciting things that's going on in visual effects today is that... And certainly one direction that this may lead to in the near future is a recreation of, say, an actor that may no longer be with us, like, say, a Marilyn Monroe. So, like last year, there was a film called My Week with Marilyn, which was a fantastic movie that Michelle Williams portrayed Marilyn Monroe in the film. But it's possible in the near future to create Marilyn Monroe completely as a computer-generated character to make a more... compelling, realistic story. So that's in the near future. I don't think we're quite there yet, but that's sort of the holy grail of what we might see in the future.
So she would have to look good enough for people to believe it, though, right? I
mean,
it would
have well, to be the movie that. The movie would not work unless it was undetectable as an illusion. Hmm. There's also an example of this just recently is that the people at Digital Domain, a visual effects company in Los Angeles, did a concert film with slain rapper Tupac. And he performed on stage with Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg in a musical number. You can Google that, and if you look at the video, it's really quite astounding.
Because mm-hmm. I've seen, you know, you've seen dancers and things. With Fred Astaire was in a commercial, I think, recently. They brought him in from an old movie to do the commercial.
Yeah, in that case, it was a repurposing right. of film clips. In this particular case, this is a completely computer-generated person. I guess what Jim Cameron would call an avatar.
You know, wasn't the Gollum in Lord of the Rings a totally generated?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And again, the component of what's making that work is that there is an actor behind it, and it's again a collaboration between the visual effects staff, animators, and an actor making a performance.
Mm-hmm. Tony, what are your feelings about this? Does animation stay away from people, or are we going to? We have to be very careful how we do this.
Well, I think there are a lot of different things that can be enabled by this technology, and it'll be interesting to see which directions things go. But as has been echoed here, actors bring such talent and warmth to the performances that I think one goal is to just help the performance and the mm-hmm. final effect be better.
So you don't think that we're going to do away totally? All three of you, Steve, you're shaking your head with actors.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think our challenge right now is to focus on how to get more of the actors driving performance into whatever character they're playing, whether it be a digital Marilyn Monroe or a totally fantastical creature. We want somebody there authoring that performance that the director's working with.
You know, people don't think about a director directing an animation. You know, what does a director do? You got the people drawing the stuff the computer's making. What does a director do in an animation?
Our directors really have the vision of the film in their head, and they're trying to explain it to the rest of the crew in a way that the film comes together as a cohesive creative whole.
So do they say, that character smiles too much? Mm-hmm. Don't make it smile so much. Like you would say to a real live-action actor, you're giving me too much energy. Give me less or more or something like that. They actually do that with the animation?
Over and over and over again.
Too much.
It's usually too much?
Yeah, sometimes.
Usually they tell actors, I need more. So it's up to the... And I guess if you have an animator, you could start working with the animator and know who the animator who gives you what you want. Like you'd be working with an actor who gives you, you want to work over and over again with the same anime. Mm-hmm. Is it like that?
It is. At Pixar, we have two kinds of actors. We have the voice actors that, like Tom Hanks and
right.
Tim Allen. And then our animators are really actors. They're just acting through the characters rather than through their own bodies.
All right. We're going to take a break and talk lots more about the animation. If you're here at the California Academy, we have a couple of microphones. You can come down to the mic. And ask questions, and we're going to be joined a little bit later by James Cameron's going to come on and talk a little bit about the animation, and he's considered to be one of the gurus of the animation projects around the world. And you can also tweet us at SciFri at SCIFRI. We're taking tweets, so we're not taking calls today because we're right here at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. So make use of the microphones. We'll be right back with our guests after this break. Stay with us. Ira here with a quick reminder to upgrade your iPhone and iPad app. We're adding all kinds of new features. We're making the app easier and more enjoyable to use. Flora's videos look just gorgeous on the iPad. You've made suggestions. We've listened to them. And over the coming days, please check iTunes and search under the keywords Science Friday, a newer, better app is waiting for you to download on iTunes. And we haven't forgotten you Android users. The updated Android app will be right behind. Now back to the show. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the science of visual effects and animation in the movies with my guest, Tony DeRose, a senior scientist and lead of the research group at Pixar Animation Studios. Steve Sullivan, senior technology officer at Industrial Light and Magic. Craig Barron is co-founder and visual effects supervisor for Matworld Digital. And you can tweet us at SciFri, at SCIFRI. Joining us now, I want to bring on is James Cameron. You all know him. He is director of Avatar, Titanic, and recently doing deep sea exploring. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, Ira. Thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate it.
It's our pleasure. Thank you for joining us. Where do you see the future of visual effects going? Is there any limitation to it?
No, I don't think there is a limitation. I think that pretty much the only limitation is the human imagination. I've been saying this for years, really for more than a decade, but I think it's really become, eminently obvious to everyone in the last, I'd say, 3 to 4 years, that if we can imagine it, we can do it.
The trend we see now is toward making 3D movies. Do you feel that 3D, we're going to be making all of our movies in 3D now?
Well, I sort of bet the farm on 3D 10 years ago, you know, started a company to build 3D cameras. So, you know, my answer, I think, is fairly obvious. Everything I do is in 3D, you know, whether it's documentary or a feature film. And I think, you know, while there are stumbling blocks along the way, and there will continue to be stumbling blocks, I think we see a steady progression toward adoption. Already at the cinema, I think we're over the major hurdles. And I see a steady progression toward adoption in the home as well, although there are different hurdles there. But I think really what we're doing is we're taking our entertainment and we're calibrating it and aligning it to our sensory system. You know, our sensory system is stereoscopic.
Mm. And we also have a old-fashioned frame rate, don't we, for films at 30 frames per second. But there's, with the advent of computers where we don't care about the frame rate, does that allow you to do things you couldn't do before?
Well, we've been stuck at 24 frames a second since the early 20s when sound first was beginning to be adopted, and it's a barely adequate frame rate. It just barely does the job. But what happens is when you increase the sense of visual acuity and physical presence that you get with 3D, the motion artifacts of 24 frames per second become more obvious. And some people notice it right away and others don't. But I think a lot of the problem that people are having with the sense of, you know, call it motion sickness, mm-hmm. when they watch 3D is when the camera pans rapidly or the subject moves rapidly, you're very aware of these edge artifacts caused by the 24 frame replacement rate. So yeah, the answer is that now that we've gone to digital projection in order to embrace 3D, the answer is right there, because these digital projectors can run at much higher frame rates.
Mm-hmm. Tony DeRose, we were talking a little bit about before about something that the human eye is capable of doing, but we haven't been able to do very much yet in the movies, and that's the high dynamic range. Explain what that is to us.
Well, the visual system is capable of all kinds of things that we're not very good at reproducing with projectors and TV monitors. The range of colors that humans can see is much larger than a TV, but also the range of intensities that the human eye can pick up is very much greater than any of the projectors or television sets that we have now. So, I think we're going to be, over the next couple of decades, pushing display technology more and more to the limits of visual acuity in every way that the visual system can work.
Mm-hmm. Just a matter of new technology, creating new technology to do that? Or?
Yeah, a lot of the technology exists, so it's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem. You know, the content and the technology has to come out together. Mm-hmm. And 3D is something that theaters are adopting now, and I don't think there's a lot of appetite for them to adopt high dynamic range anytime soon. But
they have to do one thing at a time. Get new projectors first before they... Steve, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, absolutely. These are all very interesting technologies that really impact the way you sense the film. And they have an interesting impact on the way we make the movies, too, because visual effects relies a lot on sheets. Just make the frame look good and move on. But when you add 3D into the mix, high dynamic range, higher frame rates, suddenly our palette of cheats gets much smaller, and we have to do things that are much more real, and it just ups the ante for us.
Mm-hmm. James Cameron, how do you take 3D or 2D films and make them into 3D? What do you have to do to make them look realistically 3D?
Well, it's a daunting task, because when you have a 2D film, you have zero depth information from the actual moment of photography. There's literally nothing. There's no record of where objects were, on the Z-axis. So really what you're left with is human interpretation of the image. We have a lot of stereoscopic cues kind of built into our depth cues kind of built into our visual system. We know that, you know, a very small man in the picture is probably not a very small man, probably not a 6-inch person. It's probably a full-size person very far away. Mm-hmm. That's a fairly obvious depth cue. But we have lots of others, and they're all running, you know, hundreds of times a second when we look at the world around us. So it turns out that human artists are actually pretty good when you sit them down at a computer workstation at starting to assign depth values to things in a in a two-dimensional picture. So what you do is you take a bunch of artists and you basically just kind of throw people at the problem. I think there's this myth out there that there's a kind of a magic box or a killer app, and you can stick a 2D picture in one side of it, and a good 3D picture will come out the other side of it. That's just not possible. It's a creative, human-in-the-loop, subjective process, and it involves a lot of people and a lot of man-hours or person-hours.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm thinking back to when we started seeing big visual effects in the movies, back in the 50s, and then we had VistaVision and CinemaScope and all these sort of ways to get people out of their TV sets and back into the theaters again. Are we having sort of a race like that now where we're trying to get people away from their giant screen TVs and back into the theaters by offering these new kinds of 3D experiences? Craig Barron, what do you think about that?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. You mentioned the Ten Commandments. That was in the 1950s. And, technology like VistaVision and optical effects was created in order to lure audiences back away from their TV sets to raise the bar for the theater-going experience.
Right.
And I think we are definitely at that point now in the efforts of Jim Cameron to make movies that are more compelling, something that you can't download on your iPhone is the name of the game. And increasing frame rates and improving projection and making more compelling experiences for audiences is what it's all about for the future.
Jim Cameron, you said that there's no little magical box that you can stick a 2D movie in and 3D comes out. What magical box, what technology would you like to have, and is it possible? What cutting-edge new technology would you like to wait or help to develop?
Well, I think that what I see in the immediate future is not some revolutionary new thing. We've kind of been through the revolutions. We've added sound, we've added color, we've added depth. And there are variations on all of those themes. For me, I see a consolidation in the near future of a lot of the things that have been just introduced in the last few years. The idea of virtual production and performance capture and so on, that needs to be consolidated. It's still cumbersome and expensive, although the end result, I think, speaks for itself. I think 3D, we need to consolidate. We need to improve the brightness in theaters. You can't have dynamic range if you don't have brightness. And right now, even the dynamic range of a 2D picture is not realized in a 3D movie. So I think 3D right now is about an 80 or 90% success story. But that last 10 or 20% is going to be getting the light levels up so we can enjoy, higher dynamic range. The things that I'm personally involved in developing, aside from a lot of workflow stuff having to do with the things I just mentioned, is the higher frame rate technology and what that means to the visual effects process. Because it's fine to say that the digital cameras can run at high speed, and they can, and the projectors can, but there's that bit in the middle where you're processing the image and you're adding elements to it, and you're adding, a lot of post-production visual effects that becomes more problematic at higher frame rates.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the audience here. Yes, ma'am. Step up to the mic.
If I wanted to be an animator, would I have to study computers or art?
There you go. You said both, Jim?
Absolutely both. When I was CEO of Digital Domain, I had a lot of very smart computer artists working for me, and I sent them back to school on the basics of art, linear perspective, aerial perspective, composition, all those things, because they were very smart in the area of creating surfaces and objects and rendering and so on, but they didn't really know the basics of art, and it's still a visual medium.
And Tony, do you agree with in Pixar that there's room for mathematicians and who know, have a little bit of interest in art, or what should you study if you want to get into this?
At Pixar we have a few different populations. So we have the technical crew, we have the artistic crew, and the main thing is to be really excellent at something. So if you're really a technologist, become an excellent technologist. And then broaden so that you can learn to work effectively in teams with people that think very differently.
Mm-hmm. Joining us now is our multimedia editor, Flora Lichtman, who is welcome to Science Friday, of course.
Thanks.
We'll have it back. And we have our video pick of the week today, sort of an oldie goldie.
right?
Yeah, but it's related, so we thought we would bring it out. It's a hairy quest scientific question. I'm just going to fill it with dad jokes. It's about the physics of Rapunzel's hair is the topic of this week's video pick. And we talked with Kelly Ward, who's a senior software designer for Disney, and she had studied hair modeling in school, and I didn't even know this was a field you could study, but this sort of gets to what we were talking about, become really good at something. And then she found out that Disney was making this movie about Rapunzel, and it's like the dream fairy tale ending for a student of hair modeling.
So it was the film Tangled, and in your video pic, she talks to you about how she had to mathematically model the hair and
It's a really complicated question, it turns out. So we have over 100,000 strands of hair on our real heads. In this movie, they sort of boil it down to over 100, but even that is a really complicated question. I think Tony DeRose could probably talk about this better than I could. But, you know, is the problem that they bump into each other or the static? I mean, how do you think about this problem of hair movement?
Well, as you said, there are about 100,000 hairs on a human head. There are many more on an otter.
Is that why we don't see many otter movies?
Yeah. But if you can capture the essential motion of about 100 hairs or so, or 200, then you can kind of do in-betweening for the hair and get the basic motion at dramatically lower simulation cost.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I mean, that's the one thing that Kelly mentioned, that it takes a long time to render this kind of stuff, right? Can you give us a sense of how long it takes to actually output a shake of the head?
Well, the outputting isn't so time-consuming, but doing the light simulation of how light interacts with all the hair and how the hair shadows each other, that's extremely computationally intensive.
Give us how long? For a second or two of Steve, how long would it take?
It could be overnight for a single frame.
Overnight for one frame?
Yeah, depending on the creature and what's going on. Another interesting aspect of this is while we have to get the physics right so it's kind of believable, we have to then put controls on top so animators can make the hair perform. Because what you see in the Rapunzel footage is that hair is doing something that real hair couldn't do. It needs to express something about the story there. So a lot of the challenge for our technologists is to come up with interesting controls for the animators to create performances out of physically based things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is exactly what Kelly Ward said. If you actually had Rapunzel's hair, you'd be dragging around 80 pounds.
Right.
So you wouldn't get that.
I'm Ira Plato, and this is Science Friday from NPR. Who wants to talk about the Uncanny Valley? Anybody? Steve?
Oh, boy. Happy to. Uncanny Valley, that was the terrain that we had to get across in order for Avatar to be a success. Mm-hmm. You know, I always said, you know, we're gonna try to catapult ourselves across the Uncanny Valley and land with our fingertips embedded in the opposite cliff, try to pull ourselves over. And that was the challenge for the whole team on Avatar.
And what was the big challenge? Why was it so challenging?
Well, all the main characters, you know, or most of the main characters in the film, were gonna be done completely with CG. So we had to really feel like, in order for us to have the correct emotional impact on the audience had to believe that the creatures that they were seeing, which were largely humanoid, were real. Mm-hmm. They couldn't be thinking that it was good CG or we'd be doomed. And, you know, so we had the problem, the so-called dead eye syndrome that we had to get over. And fortunately, you know, Weta Digital at the time was one of the leaders in creating a very kind of liquid, beautifully refractive eye, and I always felt that the problem was around the area of the mouth. The kind of neuromuscular interaction around the mouth that forms expression is so complex, and I always felt that that's where most CG characters broke down, not around the eyes. So I actually encouraged them to spend a lot of time and energy in that area as well.
Yeah, because if you don't get stuff like that right, it sort of comes out creepy looking. Doesn't it? I mean, the audience has a little bit of problem with it. It's almost real, but not really real.
Right. Well, the Uncanny Valley refers to a dip in positive response. It's actually meant to be, you know, kind of an XY graphing. On the Y-axis, you've got positive response to what you're seeing. And on the X-axis, it's from left to right, it's as you're approaching looking human. And so there's a point where kind of animated animals and a talking moose and so on at the left side of the graph, they're all fine because they're humanoid to the extent that they're doing human behaviors, but they don't look human. Then as you start to approach looking human, with things like androids and you know, synthetic rubber flesh on Japanese robotics experiments, and even things like corpses, where there's no movement, we start to get a very negative effect, so the curve dips. And then it comes up again sharply as you exactly approach the look of a true living human.
Mm-hmm. One last question before we have to go. Is the story still matter? The story, you know, does the animation and visual effects overwhelm the story so much that the story doesn't really matter anymore? Well, ask Jim. Jim, what do you think?
Well, look, I mean, I think we all know the answer to that question. People respond to stories, and, you know, they respond to human interaction and to emotion, and they want to have an emotional response themselves. And so I think we've seen the big, hollow kind of clanking, but quite beautiful and quite difficult visual effects extravaganzas that didn't work. And I think we've seen films that were much more modest in their effects goals that did work. You know, so I think step one is you've got to cast it right, you've got to have a great script, and you've got to be, you know, you've got to be telling a well-modulated human story throughout. Then you can start to layer on the visuals and the imaginative elements, you know, to any extent. And certainly my stuff has been, you know, with an awful lot of that. All right. But you still have to have the basics first.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us, James Cameron, Tony DeRose, Steve Sullivan, and Craig Barron. Thanks, you all, for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Ira Plato. This is Science Friday from NPR.
Speak Spanish? Ahora, Science Friday, también en español. Encuentra lo mejor de la actualidad científica hispana y del mundo en sciencefriday.com/español.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. Where is the safest place to be during an earthquake? Yeah, here in San Francisco, everybody's shaking their head. They're all thinking about it. It's always on people's mind, given that 106 years ago this week, 2 days ago in 1906, a huge earthquake rocked San Francisco and the north coast of California. People are still talking about that historic quake. So the answer to that question may be the safest place to be now, or soon to be, is on a new bridge. It rebuilt as after a section of the old one collapsed during the violent Noah Prit quake in 1989. So 23 years later, engineers say they are putting the finishing touches on the quake-proof new eastern span of the Bay Bridge, set to open next year. My next guest is the lead design engineer for the new span, which has been called an engineering marvel. Dr. Marwan Nader is also vice president of the structural engineering firm T.Y. Lin International, and he joins us here in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
You're very proud of your new bridge as it's going up?
I am.
Yeah? You should be, right?
It's certainly been a challenge, but it's certainly coming together.
And you were in San Francisco during the Loma Prieta quake in 1989. How did you get involved with designing this new eastern span of the Bay Bridge?
Well, I mean, in 1989, I was still a student at UC Berkeley, and when the earthquake occurred, I was actually in Davis Hall, where we study engineering, and the building shook quite a bit. Made it very clear for me how important it is to design structures for seismic loads. Mm-hmm. And did my research and dissertation on seismic design of structures. After that, I joined T.Y. Lin International, and I've been there since then. After 1989, in parallel with that, the California Department of Transportation was looking to retrofit major structures like the Bay Bridge, all the major crossings of the bay. And right around 1997, they put out a RFP, as we call it, for
consultants. Request for proposals.
A request for proposals for consulting firms to basically be selected to design the new Bay Bridge.
Mm-hmm. And why did the old one collapse during the quake?
Well, the old one did very well, given the fact that it was built 75 or so many years ago. Mm-hmm. At the time, we knew as an industry in engineering very little about earthquakes. In fact, we designed most of our structures for wind. And we basically had a small note that said that the seismic loads will not govern the design. Since then, we've learned a lot more. Mother Nature has a good way of reminding us how to put our structures up. Mm-hmm. And the bridge itself has two big challenges to it. Unlike the Golden Gate and unlike the western spans of the bridge, Bay Bridge, where the foundations are sitting on large caissons, and those caissons are supported directly on rock, the eastern spans of the Bay Bridge are sitting in very deep soils.
Mud, sorry. They're in mud.
They're mud, practically yeah. muck, if you want to call it better than mud. And those soils actually have very little, they amplify the ground motion, and they have very little resistance in terms of when compared to bedrock. And mm-hmm. the piling of the existing structure is about, you know, 30 meters deep. They're actually timber piles. They're 30-meter types, and there are many, many, many of those. And that particular foundation is not made to resist the seismic motions that we're dealing with. The other part of it is the fact that the existing eastern spans have is a thrust structure. And by default, a thrust structure has many connections, many members, unlike a suspension bridge, and thereby retrofitting those members to satisfy the new design codes would require a lot of work, overhead traffic, and blocking lanes.
But if you look at your design of your new bridge, it's almost unlike anything we've seen before around this part of the United States or this part of the world.
Well, there's a couple of things. Obviously, 90% of the bridge itself is a segmental construction type, and that's rather typical right. of that. And the part that I believe you're referring to is the signature span,
yes.
which is the self-anchored suspension bridge.
Describe that to an audience that can't see it.
Well, the signature span is like a suspension bridge that you see, where the cables basically have a catenary shape to them. There's a couple of big differences about it. The first one is that the cable itself, unlike a suspension bridge where the cable is anchored into an anchorage, and the anchorage is actually anchored in the ground, which is effectively a five-story building that basically anchors in the ground. A self-anchored suspension bridge takes that cable and anchors it in the deck. So it becomes kind of like a hanging basket where the actual loads from the cable are going into the deck, and the deck is subject to compression. Mm-hmm. And so that's one feature of the self-anchored suspension bridge, which makes it very unique. The other part of it, which is also unique to this bridge, is the fact that the cable itself is in a three-dimensional space. Most cables that we see on suspension bridges tend to be in a vertical plane. As you're driving, you see the cables on one side and
right.
another cable on another side.
Right.
And if you look at that cable, it's vertical. The suspenders come, the ropes come vertically from it, and that's how the bridge is suspended. In this particular bridge, the cable is actually occupying a three-dimensional cable. It starts at the single tower, which is in the middle of the road, and actually splays out and has a and goes out to the extremities of the roadway, and thereby giving you a cathedral look, if you will, when you drive through it.
So does the cable loop back again?
It does.
Can you see that from the roadway?
No, you can't. You can't. Yeah. Actually, the looping aspect of it has multiple aspects. One of it is obviously an engineering design. It was driven to satisfy design equilibrium, and it was driven to make sure that the cable itself is anchored into the deck. Mm-hmm. The angle at which the cable is coming down is, which is close to about 30 degrees, is sharp. And thereby anchoring it into the deck, as you can imagine, would be a little more difficult because you have to turn the cable. And yeah. rather than turning it in a vertical plane, we turned it into a horizontal plane. Thereby, like the belt around your waist, we looped it around. And this, in many aspects, that aspect of it is a first of its kind. It's a borrowed industry from pre-stressed concrete bridges where we have a lot of the tendons looped around in a U form and looped that way, but it's never been done on a suspension bridge like this one.
Well, we're here at the California Academy of Sciences, and in the audience, please feel free. You're going to have a chance like you never had to ask about the Bay Bridge if you want to know something about it, so step up to the microphone and if it concerns you at all. I noticed from the designs is that the bridge is made in different pieces so that parts can move independently of one another. Correct?
That's correct.
When the earth shakes, it all just sort of floats.
Right. The seismic design, the way we understand it, is basically there are effectively two ways to resist the motions. One is to really design a bunker. which effectively is very strong to take the forces.
So you're fighting nature.
Yes, and what you're doing there is you're really taking on whatever the motions are. And the earthquake has a very interesting characteristic to it. It's like a musical, effectively. It's got areas where there's a lot of energy, which is at the frequencies that are very, very low or very, you know, very, very high, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And then that's where you're getting the most energy. And then as you get the structure to be more flexible, that's where the energy gets smaller. So if you are a little bit careful about it, you can actually design your structure to be in the areas where the earthquake is less damaging. And by making that structure tuned to what Mother Nature is going to apply, you actually avoid that grunt of the force. The other aspect of it is designing components, if you will, that are made to take on the damage. Like when we drive cars, if you think about it, cars, we know we drive cars. We know that we'd like not to get in an accident, but we plan for that accident. And the
it's
idea
like crumple zones.
Exactly. Yeah. And the idea behind it is you get the damage to occur in areas where you keep the car functional to the extent possible when it's a mid-sized type of a accident that you have. And the idea is that the fenders take all the damage. Very similar to that is our bridge is designed that way. We actually looked at specific areas, which we said that's where it makes sense to have the damage occur. We designed those elements to take on that damage and thereby protecting the more important elements to it.
So you can replace those damaged pieces later on.
Exactly. The idea is that after an event, the bridge is still functional. We would go and obviously the engineers at the time would go in and do an inspection,
right.
Evaluate. There will be damage, but it will be in a form where you can actually make it available so that emergency traffic can be immediately after that, go on it, and shortly after that, go to normal traffic.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get some questions from our audience here. Yes, sir.
Yes, I remember when the Bay Bridge was starting, and it was mirrored with a lot of, like, scandal about bad wells, and how's that being addressed? Did they have to start over, or what's the cost overruns and things like that?
Well, I'm not sure I follow the specific event, but in general, this question goes back to quality. If you think about it, and one of the issues that is great about our engineering profession is that we basically have design codes, we have standards, and we have qualification for quality and assurance that we mm-hmm. follow. And the idea behind it is that every weld, every material that we have is inspected either during the fabrication or prior to using that material that it satisfies those qualities. And if it's not satisfying them, it gets rejected. It gets pulled out. There is a sense that when you sometimes find something that wasn't good, that you we did something wrong. And mm-hmm. in fact, it's the other way around. If you think about it, it's the due diligence that we do that uncovers those situations, so to speak.
I'm Ira Plato. This is Science Friday from NPR, talking with Dr. Marwan Nader. We talked, last week, a couple weeks ago on the show about the Brooklyn Bridge. And it turned out that Roebling, who had designed the Brooklyn Bridge, discovered that it was being made with substandard steel cabling on it. And he had designed so much redundancy or overload into it that it went from 10 times its capacity to only 6 times what it could hold. I imagine you need to do some sort of like that redundancy in the bridge.
And you're so right about that. It's in the engineering intent. And what you do is you look at sometimes the situation you're faced with and you look at if there is a need to perform what we refer to as does this particular element satisfy the design intent, and thereby do you really need to go in there and do work to it, or is it okay the way it is? Mm-hmm.
And it's been designed to last 150 years, which is a lot longer than most bridges are
yes.
designed to last. What of the design features helps in that longevity?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, what does 150 year mean? Just to give us a sense, most of our buildings that we design, most of our bridges tend to have a design life which is 50 years to 75 years. And as engineers, what we work with is we work on probability and we work in recurrence. So the idea is that if you have a longer window, then the probability of having a larger earthquake or a larger wind event becomes, the event itself becomes larger.
Right.
You also have to look at the maintenance of the structure and make sure that it satisfies that 150-year design life. What happens in this particular case, obviously the one driving aspect of it is the seismic loads that we have in the Bay Area. And what it did is it magnified the ground motion that we're designing it for. We wind up designing for an earthquake that has a 1,500-year return period, much like the earthquake that we had a 1906 earthquake.
Okay, let's get a question from the audience here. Yes, sir.
Yeah, following up on that comment, what's the process for deciding how strong an earthquake to design the bridge to withstand?
Well, we obviously have our seismologists and the geologists, which look at the pattern and the history, and ultimately we start with looking at all the faults that are in the Bay Area, the proximity. In the Bay Area, we have two very large faults, frankly. One of them is the San Andreas Fault, which produced the 1906 earthquake, which runs a few miles away from the Golden Gate and runs up and down the coast of California, goes all the way down to Southern California. The other one is the Hayward Fault, which is in the Berkeley Hills and is also a major earthquake. So those quakes, we basically look at their seismic hazard, if you will, and from that generate possible or potential seismic hazard, and then we get intensities based on the soils that we have, based on the history of ground motions that we've recorded, we come up with those intensities at very different frequencies I was talking about earlier. And then from that, we generate a spectrum that ultimately gets used to generate multiple different simulated ground motions that we take our structure and in a computer model, we run that structure and we subject it to those displacements. And the computer model is intended to do the equilibrium statically at every instant in time, microsecond. And the target would be that we know what the forces are in our structure and what the displacements are in our structure.
Now, let me see if I can get a quick question in. Yes, from the
chair. A quick question is, we have a lot of information, video, interviews, and so forth from the 1989 earthquake on the Bay Bridge, and we know the personal experiences. If a same magnitude earthquake occurred with your design, what would the human experience be while driving across the bridge?
Well,
what differences would
it be the safest place to be, like I mentioned before?
It would certainly be a safest place to be, and it would actually feel much like a joyride. The difference is that you're not necessarily planning on it, and as you feel it, I would suggest that you slow down and you get to reach a parking situation, and just. Once the earthquake is done, 50 seconds later or so, drive on.
To see, well, that doesn't mention about the roads that lead up to it. If they're going to be around, your bridge will be there, but the roads may not.
Actually, that's a very good question. And, obviously we look at these things, and the reality of it is that we only have one bridge in the area that crosses the bay from the East Bay to San Francisco, while we have multiple other roads.
All right. And that's going to be the problem. Thank you very much, Dr. Marwan Nader, for joining us. He's a lead design engineer for the new Bay Bridge, the self-anchored suspension bridge. Our program's senior producers, Ed Heist, Charles Berquist, and Gwen Uten are our directors. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our associate senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Namisha Srinanan and Louis Vado. Sam Plato is our production assistant. Neil Rauch is our technical director. Our engineers are Marcia Caldwell and Sean Phillips. If you missed any part of our program, go to iTunes and subscribe to our podcasts, audio and video. And our phone app is produced by Pastime Software. I'm Ira Flato in San Francisco.